You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
All right, so the first story, the game has changed. AI triumphs at solving protein structures.
Yeah, so this is quite an interesting thing. It could be a sort of a game changer. So one of the big challenges in biology has been trying to understand how proteins form. So proteins, you probably know, proteins are made of amino acids, and these are long chains, and those chains sort of ball up and curl up into three-dimensional shapes that allow them to make these proteins and do the things that proteins do. But in order to make drugs or to try and identify ways that we can affect the way that proteins function, we really need to know how their structures in really good detail. The human body uses tens of thousands of different proteins, each a different string of amino acids to make these proteins. And knowing the shapes helps researchers devise the drugs that can lodge in the pockets and proteins and crevices and things. And they can also synthesize proteins with desired structures that could make speed the development of enzymes and make biofuels and degrade plastics and all sorts of amazing things. But for decades and decades, researchers have deciphered proteins. So they've studied protein structures and worked out their structures using experimental techniques like X-ray crystallography or electron microscopy, all at low temperatures. But that can take months or even years for a single protein. And so far, only about 170,000 structures have been solved out of more than 200 million proteins discovered across sort of all life forms. And so from about the 1960s, researchers realized that if they could work out all individual interactions in a protein sequence, they could predict its three-dimensional shape. And with hundreds of amino acids per protein and many ways that each amino acid can interact with each other, you know, hundreds or thousands or even millions of interactions in a protein, it's a really big computational problem. And up until very, very recently, it's been one that hasn't been solvable. 1994, some scientists launched a competition. And in this competition, took place every couple of years. Scientists got amino acid sequences for about 100 proteins, and some of them computed structures, and some of them determined structures experimentally, and then the organizers compared the two and gave scores out. And scores above 90, the computations were considered basically on a par with the experimental methods. But even in 1994, even small, very, very simple proteins, you know, the computations couldn't match the experimental results. And for big proteins, the scores were terrible. Scores were around about 20, which were very bad. Even as recently as 2016, big proteins, people calculating the structures for big proteins, were only getting scores for about 40 or so for the hardest proteins. So we're still a long way off. And then people started using artificial intelligence. And a company called DeepMind created an algorithm So this company started using artificial intelligence. And when they first entered this competition in 2018, they won very easily, beating the competition by about 15%, scoring up to about 60 for the hardest targets. But then they worked out that they could actually do better by adding an algorithm called an attention algorithm that actually mimics the way a person might assemble, say, a jigsaw puzzle. So when you put a jigsaw puzzle together, you first look at connecting small pieces or connecting the pieces in small clumps, that is, So they could be like clusters of amino acids. And then you want to sort of search for a way to join those clumps to a larger whole. And so they added this algorithm and trained the computer to predict or basically the computer learned by looking at this, the 170,000 or so structures, known protein structures. And then they entered the competition again, and it seems to have worked. So across target proteins in this year's competition, this software achieved a median GDT score, so this the score of about 92. And remember, anything above 90 is considered basically good enough, perfect, in terms of being close enough to experimental structures. And this was 25 points ahead of anyone else. And it even excelled at solving structures that were particularly difficult, that sat in wedged in membranes and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. So the organizers were a bit were amazed and a little bit dubious, and they thought they may have been cheating in some sort of way. So they were set a special challenge, a particularly difficult protein that hadn't actually, in 10 years of study, experimental study, hadn't been figured out. The structure hadn't been solved. But it seems the software looked at it, figured it out computationally, solved it, and they went back, used that computational structure to try and solve their experimental data, and it's almost perfect, and it worked, and they figured it out. And so
this is incredibly significant, right?
This is hugely significant. It really is. This is why I wanted to talk about this first, because you know, this is being able to know the sequence of a protein, know the amino acid sequence, and then derive the structure just using a computer will save, you know, an immense amount of time, experimental time, trying to solve these protein structures. But it can also open up a whole amazing array of possible technological outcomes, from health to environmental outcomes, to all sorts of amazing things. It will enable drug designers to work out structures of proteins in pathogens like the SARS-CoV-2 pathogen. They can looking at molecules that can block that pathogen. They can do all sorts of amazing things. So this is an incredible advance.
Yeah, that's a huge advancement. I can't wait to see how this helps improve things in the future. So the second story is Oxford's COVID vaccine is still apparently puzzling scientists.
Yeah, so I think a couple of weeks ago I talked about the two vaccines that had been announced, and the one from Pfizer, I think, and one from a company called Moderna. And they both had, it seemed they had a success rate in excess of 90%. And then recently, in the last week or so, Oxford and AstraZeneca have been working on a vaccine, and they announced a 70% effective vaccine. And you think, oh, that's no good. But it seems like the story's a little bit deeper than that. There were actually two, by accident, in fact, the vaccine was given in studies two different ways. This was not supposed to happen. All the recipients of the vaccine were supposed to receive it in the same way, in two doses, two full doses, given about a month apart. But some of the recipients, I think about a third of them, actually received a lower dose for their first dose and then a full dose for their second dose. And it seems like the people who received the lower first dose, in that population, the vaccine was about 90% effective. Okay, but people who received two full doses, the vaccine was only about 62% effective. And so the average overall of all the recipients was about 70%, which is where they get the number from. But they don't really know why those getting a smaller first dose seemed to respond better to the vaccine. And they are trying to figure this out. Now, there is some uncertainty because maybe the statistics isn't enough. Maybe that just not enough people got this lower first dose. If you look at the numbers, there are about 2,700 participants who got the lower, I think it was a half dose for their first dose, versus about 9,000 who got a full first dose. And so one explanation could lie in the data. The trial may not have been big enough to really gauge the differences between the two regimes. And so once they test on more people, the difference might vanish. But some of the scientists are pretty convinced that the differences are real, and they're trying to figure out why. So one scientist was talking about a lower dose of vaccine could do a better job at stimulating a subset of immune cells called T cells that support the production of antibodies. Another potential explanation is the immune system response to it's actually a modified chimpanzee virus that forms the vaccine, and the immune system response to the chimpanzee virus the vaccine could trigger a reaction not only to the bit of the vaccine that contains the sort of the SARS-CoV-2 protecting part, but also to the components of the actual chimpanzee virus from which it was sort of derived. And it's possible that the first full dose blunted the reaction. And so there's getting a smaller full dose could actually help. So they're trying to get more data. The company has so far given the vaccine to around about 10,000 participants in the US arm of the trial. And those results hopefully will come out soon. But the company is going to ask regulators. You see, they have to get permission. They have to get for the structure of how they're going to do these tests. So they have to ask the regulators whether they can modify the trial to include the dosing system, the dosing regimen that works better. So sort of a half a full dose for the first dose, and then a full for the second dose. So they're going to get permission to try and do that, and then do the trial on a lot more people with that sort of balance. But the news is generally good. So there was no participants who received the vaccine were hospitalized or developed severe COVID-19. So in suggesting the vaccine might do a good job at preventing the severe disease. So even if you got that COVID-19, you didn't get it severely. There was also hints that the vaccine might prevent infected people from transmitting the virus. So even if they weren't showing symptoms, that they would maybe transmit it less.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And also even with a sort of a lower efficacy rate, it still might be the vaccine of choice because it is stable at refrigerator temperatures. And the big deal about those first couple of vaccines that with the really high effectiveness was that they needed to be stored at very low temperatures. So the first one, the Pfizer one, was needed to be stored at minus 70, which is not something that's particularly easy to do, especially in developing nations. The Oxford AstraZeneca one could still be the one of choice, even if it is a little bit less effective, just because it's cheaper.
Mm. And so the final story today, a telescope has collapsed, ending a 57-year run.
Yeah, so have you ever heard of the Arecibo telescope?
No, I haven't.
No, okay. So the Arecibo Observatory Telescope was one of the largest telescopes in the world. So basically, it was a big crater, actually, that they filled in with a dish. So the dish wasn't movable, but it was about 100 feet, so 30 meters wide. And it was in Costa Rica, and sorry, in Puerto Rico, I should say. It's been around for 57 years. It was made famous as the backdrop for films, for James Bond films, and the movie Contact, and a few other films. And it was built in the 1960s. It was originally intended to study the ionized upper part of the Earth's atmosphere, but it soon became used as an all-purpose radio observatory, so it's a radio telescope. And it made a number of major discoveries, including pulsars, and earned a Nobel Prize, at least one Nobel Prize. It helped make the first definitive detection of exoplanets, so that's planets orbiting other stars, and that was in 92. And it's also listened to for signals from intelligent life. So it's a very significant telescope, very, very, very massive. But it's been in a state of disrepair. And so just in the last few days, it's sort of over this big crater which contained the dish, there was strung a 900-ton instrument platform. So this was in the middle, way above the actual bottom of the crater, but in the middle of the dish, this 900-ton platform was suspended. And a few days ago, it collapsed. No one was hurt. It was already in a state of being decommissioned as of the 19th of November, because a few of the cables broke that put the platform, really, they realized it was on the brink of collapse. They were hoping to for it to go in a sort of a controlled demolition, but in the end, it didn't survive long enough. And so this is a sort of a significant piece of astronomical history that in the end felt a sort of an ignominious end.
Have they found out why it collapsed?
I think old age. And maybe people weren't it wasn't a major force anymore. People weren't investing money to keep it up. But I think, it was old, 60 years old. It's been nearly 60 years old.
Yeah, it's still sad, though, that something this significant in, as you say, astronomical history has come to an end like that, though.
It is. And if you look at, if you go online and look at sort of Google Arecibo and look at some pictures, it's pretty incredible. It was a pretty incredible instrument.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.